You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Ken Burgen, Executive Director of Pache Bene, who shares the exciting news about 758 nonviolent actions and events happening in all 50 states and 18 countries during the Campaign Nonviolence Week of Actions to build a culture of peace and active nonviolence.
What if we say once and for all, let's get rolling on actually building a powerful, resilient, beautiful culture or cultures of peace and nonviolence all around the planet? It may take us 500 years, but that's okay. We're going to get rolling.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe, Agwanu, I'm coming to you from my home in the Don Land, and it is an incredibly beautiful day here, Wuligaskut, and we are located in and along the shorelines of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine, and as always, fortunately for me, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's also quite beautiful out here in Taos, New Mexico, although the change of seasons is upon us. We had our first heavy frost and snowfall on the top, the very, very top of the mountains. And Daryl and I took our annual pilgrimage up to the Aspen Grove, way up high in the mountains, so high that your blood starts feeling like it doesn't have enough oxygen. And just celebrated change and turning seasons. And today we get to talk about a very beautiful change and transformation that's happening kind of under the radar. But today we're going to talk about a story of a movement called Campaign Nonviolence that has been pretty quietly and perseveringly going out to build a culture of active nonviolence. We have Ken Burgen returning to the show. Our listeners will remember him from our conversation about the work with getting the Vatican to have a conference on just peace and nonviolence. That has borne fruit, and we'll be sure to ask Ken about it. Ken is the executive director of Pache Bene, the organization that runs Campaign Nonviolence. He's also a professor in the Peace and Justice Studies Department at DePaul University. And he's the author of a brand new book called Nonviolent Lives, People and Movements Changing the World Through the Power of Active Nonviolence. Welcome back to Love and Revolution Radio, Ken.
Oh, thanks so much, Rivera, Sherry. It's really wonderful to be with you again.
Ken, we're thrilled that you can join us again to help us to highlight some of these events that have been going on. And there are so many things that have been going on, too many for us to cover in one show. Would you like to share with us some of the highlights that you've picked up along the way of the actions that have been taking place?
Yes, it's been a fabulous week, I think, for 2016, but maybe even for the future. The importance of people all across the United States and in 18 nations taking to the streets and calling for a culture of peace and nonviolence, free from war, poverty, racism, environmental destruction, and for good measure, the epidemic of violence. This is Campaign Nonviolence, and we all deserve a culture of peace and nonviolence. We all deserve to live in a culture of peace and nonviolence, to thrive in a culture of peace and nonviolence, to help build one. And several years ago, a number of us who had been many years involved in single-issue organizing thought, well, what about a framework that says, what about this culture we want to all live in? Regarding all the things that we were working on, whether that is police brutality or fracking, drones, wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, or in my history, nuclear weapons, organizing around U.S. policies in Central America and homelessness. What if we say once and for all, let's get rolling on actually building a powerful, resilient, beautiful culture or cultures of peace and nonviolence all around the planet? It may take us 500 years, but that's okay. We're going to get rolling. And so in 2014, we launched Campaign Nonviolence, Pacha Bene, and we found that there were people across the United States and beyond who said, sign me up for that. I want to be part of this. I want a piece of this. And so 240 events in September of 2014, last year, 370. And we're just so excited to announce that we've had a doubling of those events this past week. So we're at 758, so twice as many as last year. And so many people have been involved in helping to make this possible, including our own Rivera Sun, and as well as people, organizers and promoters all over the United States and beyond. Let me just say that I visited Uganda in January, this past January. It was a real privilege to meet with 150 peace builders in East Africa, places like Tanzania and Burundi and South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, that all of which have faced enormous violence and injustice. And here they were building peace, restorative justice, reconciliation, lots of facets of really a new world. And so with some trepidation, I mentioned, oh, and we're also trying to do our bit too at Pacha Bene and beyond, organizing something called Campaign Nonviolence for a Culture of Peace and Nonviolence. And I saw the lights just come on in everyone's eyes saying, oh, that's what we're doing too. We're building a culture of peace and nonviolence. And in fact, they said, you know, this, what we're doing concretely fits into this overall framework. And I was very moved and encouraged by that. And it really gives me a sense that what we and others in this country and around the world are longing for and hungering for is a canopy of nonviolence in which to locate all of our longings, our hopes, our dreams, but also our very concrete steps for change. And that's what we're hoping we're about with Campaign Nonviolence. And we've just been hearing from incredible actions all across the United States. And I want to get into those in a moment, but I would just offer my vision of this, which is that we come together once for a week, one time a year, to converge. And at the same time, we're all doing amazing work all year long on whatever issue that we're led by passion to grapple with, seek to transform, create an alternative. So it really, there is this question, how do we build a culture of peace and nonviolence? Well, we're doing it in all of our local ways, small and large. And then once a year, we get together for a week and coast to coast across the U.S. and then around the world, we say, oh, and we're all part of this effort to see this transformation. So I've been very encouraged and excited about this, and it bodes well in spite of all the violence and injustice in the world that we're seeing. We're part of a movement of movements way beyond Campaign Nonviolence that's at this historical moment saying, it's time for a nonviolent shift.
I think one of the beautiful things, and here's a disclaimer to the listeners, is that I get to do the social media work for Campaign Nonviolence and some of the program's coordination. So this is an endeavor and a week of actions that I've gotten to spend 24/7 practically this week watching these reports and photos and stories and comments from people online about what this means to them. And what has been very heartening to me is to see very diverse communities, places like Memphis, Chicago, Wilmington, Delaware, that are really building across both classes and races, a lot of interfaith actions that have been going on. There was a lot of work being done in this particular week of actions, bridging from Muslim communities into other faith groups and into the general public as a way of countering Islamophobia and talking about the ongoing wars and, well, we don't declare war anymore, but the ongoing quote-unquote military operations happening in the Middle East. So for me, it was very heartening to see that there's something about the idea of a culture of peace and active nonviolence that many people are taking to heart in their own way. I like how you said, Ken, that it's really we're building cultures of active nonviolence. They don't all look the same. I mean, groups in Little Rock, Arkansas, and Santa Rosa, California, or Clinton, Iowa, or Detroit, Michigan, they're interpreting what culture means to them in their own ways. And it's really beautiful to see all these different variations happening. Ken, would you like to talk a little bit about some of the actions that have moved you? I know you were part of a large march in Chicago that kicked off the week of actions, and perhaps you'd like to talk about some of the things that are happening in D.C. at the Pentagon and in Wilmington, Delaware as well.
Oh, thanks, Rivera. Yes. So right at the beginning of the week, I was really privileged to be part of a march against gun violence and for peace on the south side of Chicago in the Auburn-Gresham neighborhood, which has suffered a huge amount of gun violence. And it was led by a community based at a church in that area called St. Sabina's Church. And the priest there, Father Michael Flager, who has been for 37 years at that church, helped lead this, and I was enormously moved by the hundreds of people who, traversing different gang territories as we launched from the church and headed out into the streets of Chicago, calling for an end to gun violence, but also to remedy the torn safety net, the torn culture that does not respond to the needs of the people in those neighborhoods. A very strong and powerful witness, a pilgrimage that we went on that night, stopping at different places where people had been killed, where the community had made a determination that this business as usual violence was no longer going to be the case. And where the leadership at this particular church has gone very deeply into facing this violence and taking very strong steps now for many years to heal the woundedness and to meet the needs also of these young people who have been involved in this violence. And so that was extremely powerful. I just want to mention another action I was part of in Chicago. So this would be 5 days later, a very different kind of action, and yet still kind of bridging the spectrum of what it means to build a culture of peace and nonviolence. So this was, I think, seven of us, and this had been organized by my good friend Sue Ellen Samakoski, who teaches at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. And she was part of a global effort on the Equinox, September 20, it's actually held on the 22nd, and where people all around the world, hour by hour, were doing actions for peace and nonviolence. And so this was the one that she organized, and I joined in, and she asked me to do a couple of exercises that I do in workshops around the two hands of nonviolence. On the one hand, I will not cooperate with your injustice. On the other hand, I'm open to you as a human being, and then playing with those two hands in our group, then milling and reflecting on our experiences of violence and nonviolence. Even if we didn't know our partner's life history, we can assume that all of us have experienced violence and nonviolence. And that was a very moving thing. And then she kind of concluded this with, with walking meditation. And it was all, interestingly enough, it was in this part of Chicago where you can see the skyline, but it's actually down by the water, a very beautiful contemplative site. So I felt that those two actions, marching with great fervor and grief in the streets of Chicago, and then also in moving in another way through guided meditation and reflection on nonviolence as a group, one large, the other small. And I think that captured the range of activities across the country. So, Rivera, you mentioned Wilmington, Delaware, and I just cannot get over what they're doing there. So 2 years ago, the folks there organized a march, Campaign Nonviolence March, for the first week of actions that we organized. It really just was so astonishing. They had 1,000 people come out to respond to the inner city gun violence there. But it also included people from within Wilmington, but also the suburbs and other parts of Delaware. And that's what happened this last week. There was this powerful, very diverse, very inclusive march. And maybe there can be on the website a link to a video that was done from it, because I think it would be wonderful if everybody in the country were to watch that 2-minute video that summarized this powerful effort to come together and to say, we are going to build a culture of peace. We're not going to just march for a culture of peace and nonviolence. We're going to build a culture of peace and nonviolence. So Wilmington, Delaware, I can't say enough about the powerful efforts that they're making there. Memphis, Tennessee, I was so moved when I heard the reports of what they organized. They were at the very place where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, the Lorraine Motel, which is the iconic wing of the National Civil Rights Museum. There was a point where developers in Memphis were going to tear the Lorraine Motel down, and people rose up and said, no, this is too important for our nation's identity and reality. And they saved Lorraine Motel, and they built the Civil Rights Museum. I've been there. It's a very powerful place. We should all make a pilgrimage there. Well, they had the, among many other events that happened throughout Memphis last week, they had a very powerful event. Again, very diverse, very inclusive, very symbolic of the kind of world we want to build, where here in this place of great destruction, where one of the greatest human beings who ever lived was killed, that the seeds of a culture of peace and nonviolence that he himself planted and others, of course, are starting to sprout. And we saw some of that in this amazing, amazing effort there. So whether we're talking about the walk to end the death penalty in Boise, Idaho, or planting trees in Coral Springs, Florida, or a vigil for peace and an end to racism, poverty, environmental destruction in Eureka, California, or an interfaith peace service with traditional music and prayers in Honolulu, Hawaii, or the efforts to say we are going to build a culture of water in Detroit and Flint, where water is such an important struggle and issue for peace and nonviolence and justice. All of these things are flickering, illuminating dimensions of what we long for. We long for a culture where everyone counts, where we get what we need. You know, Dr. King talked about building the world house, living in the world house. Some of us live down at the end that has the swimming pool and the sauna, and others of us live down at the end where there's no roof. He says, but we're all in the same house, and we all have to live together. And I think in our own modest way, that's what we're trying to do with Campaign Nonviolence.
Ken, you talked about keeping movements going, about people coming out and saying, we're not just going to march in the streets, we're actually going to keep this movement going. How do people do that? How do people keep the momentum of these moments in time going and keep those individuals who show up, keep the masses active after the event is over? What are some of the real practical things that people can do to keep people moving, to keep people motivated, to keep them engaging in these actions that are going to actually start turning the tide? Because as we know, it doesn't work if people just show up for the big events. There has to be a concerted effort to keep the movement going forward, to keep the pressure applied at the strategic points. So what are some of the things that people can do to ensure that that happens following this week?
Well, Sherry, one of the great things about Campaign Nonviolence thus far is we have people from all spectrums of involvement in movement. Some people, this is their very first time. What an exciting thing. Some people have been pouring themselves into this kind of work for decades. And so what you're raising is really important. How do we build a culture of peace and nonviolence? It won't be just for 1 week at a time, though I think that's important, actually. I think to see ourselves connected like that, connecting the dots, connecting one another at a certain pivotal moment is really good. And we're going to continue to organize those annual convergences. At the same time, your question's a profound and important one, because to build a culture of peace and nonviolence does mean building a long-term movement that will both lift up the beauty of what we're headed toward, but also assiduously resist the many forms of violence and injustice that prevent us from living fully in a culture of peace and nonviolence now. So that involves work. But before we get to the work, I would encourage every person who participated, and we're estimating that thousands and thousands and thousands of people participated this past week in the Campaign Nonviolence efforts, that every person, including those who were directly responsible for organizing those 758 events, to celebrate. Celebrate, celebrate, celebrate. We need to celebrate the fact that we have gone public with our commitment, our longing, our hope for change, our commitment to nonviolence, not to violent change, not to injustice, not violence stopping violence, but this wacky, beautiful, resilient, liberating, audacious notion that this third way between passivity and violence is actually the way we're going to move forward as a world. If we survive the 21st century, it's because we have figured out how to live nonviolently with one another. So celebration, but then also, how do we build on what we've been doing? So Pache Bene, for 25 years, has believed that one of the key things is nonviolence education, trainings, workshops, retreats, classes, presentations. So we are always up for that, and we encourage everyone to not only celebrate and reflect on what we've done, but also to prepare for the next steps by going more deeply into what a nonviolent change is all about. We are given a training, a workshop 24/7 in violence in our society. And so we need some deconditioning. We need some relearning. We need to see that there's an alternative. And the great thing is, unlike 100 years ago when Gandhi was starting to do this stuff, we actually have so many resources at our disposal for restorative justice and anti-racism training and for trauma healing, as well as classic nonviolent social movement building. So training is really important. And we encourage that to happen all the time. And Pache Bene has been one of the lead organizers of a project called the 1000 Nonviolence Training Project, where we have a vision of giving a shout out to and even organizing some of the nonviolence trainings going on in this country and beyond. And we're right now, I think it's something like 650 trainings that we've raise the visibility of and encourage people to participate in. But you can also call Pache Bene, and we're happy to help with any kind of training. The second thing, though, is to really begin to look very closely. If you're working on fracking, how are you part of a larger life cycle of change in your locality? And how does that hook up with the larger movement in the United States or the larger movement globally around that particular pernicious challenge to wholeness and healing and a life where the earth counts and everyone in the earth counts? So in other words, we also encourage our convergence every year for a week being a time to celebrate how during the rest of the year we're involved in an effort to make change. And we don't have to do everything, as somebody once famously said, but we can do something. And that's very important that something be part of an actual movement building strategy. So at Pache Bene, one of the strategies we use, or at least the models we like to use in our trainings, is the 8 stages of a social movement that helps us evaluate, well, where is this movement? It's not enough just to show up one day a year. So who are the other people in my city or my state or my country or my globe that are involved in these efforts? And where are we in the timeline of getting to success using active, creative, nonviolent people power strategies? Very, very important. Now, one way we've talked about this at Pache Bene that we put out beginning last year was the idea of a nonviolent city. Now, this could be applied to a nonviolent rural area as well. But the notion that the city I'm in faces a lot of violence and injustice. I live in Chicago. We have a huge amount of violence and injustice here. So what would it take to actually build nonviolent Chicago? Well, that's probably a many-decade project, but we want to start with that idea because I actually think that there's a lot of liberating energy that comes from that rubric, that notion. I'm going to call this Nonviolent Chicago, or as they did in Memphis in their efforts this past week, envisioning nonviolent Memphis. They're not saying it's nonviolent yet, but what would it be to get there? How do you get there? Who needs to sit down? What's the scope of the violence we're talking about? What's the scope of the nonviolence? And then one of the things that often happens with nonviolence is that we think of it as just as a utopia. And even to say nonviolent Chicago sounds utopian, but I'm not talking about a utopia. I'm talking about a city where more and more of us are equipped with not only the vision, but also the toolbox for making change where we are. And that's what we at Pache Bene feel. That's one way to think about building a movement, is to think about our localities. How can we see them as places of nonviolence? What I often say to my students, where we actually try to design nonviolent cities, and Rivera and I did this one time at a workshop we were part of at DePaul University where I teach. I say, think about all the violence and nonviolence on the plot of land you live on, going back for thousands of years. Think about all the violence that's happened here, but also think about the unrecorded nonviolence that's happened here. We're on the fulcrum of history between the past and the future. We can both learn the grievous lessons of the violence that's happened under our feet and still are happening, but then also learn the amazing resources and resilience of nonviolence that's happened here, even if it was never called that. That ability to get to a win-win that was not violent or passive. So I think you're on to something when you ask, how do we build on this? How do we make sure it's not just some rote event that we do? It's a challenge. We don't have all the answers, but I think it's training. I think it's organizing, it's finding other people, it's celebrating, and considering something like a nonviolent city. And even if it takes us 50 years to go 1/10 of the way there, it's going to be better than it was.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
Move toward what you think about you. Move toward what you think about you. Move toward what you think about you. You move toward what you think about you. Move toward what you think about you. Move toward what you think about you.
On this week's Nonviolent Minute, we explore the concept of training your community for a culture of active nonviolence. In today's show, Campaign Nonviolence Director Ken Buttigan mentioned how we're all subjected to 24/7 training in the culture of violence. So, that begs the question. If we weren't studying the myths and mythologies of violence, what would we be studying instead? Well, here's a few suggestions. First of all, we can all take some time to learn our nonviolent history. The Global Nonviolent Action Database, which is available online for free, is a great resource for reading over 1,000 case studies about nonviolent movements, campaigns, groups, and organizations. Secondly, let's study how nonviolent action works to make change. Learn the dynamics, strategies, and tactics. Thirdly, we can explore the work of peace team skills, such as the knowledge that our guest Kim Redigan spoke about on one of our previous shows. Conflict resolution and de-escalation skills are useful for everyone in every community. And lastly, in today's list, for there are many, many more, we should start to learn how restorative justice can act as a critical component of the culture of active nonviolence. There are, of course, many other types of trainings you could initiate in your area to help to build this culture of skilled, knowledgeable, wise, and empowered active nonviolence. So, start with these and keep on adding. You never know, but nonviolence may change your life.
Our thoughts determine our future.
This week's featured music is Future by Galen Goodwill on her Lovers of Wisdom album. You can find her work on cdbaby.com, and you can also follow her at Galen Goodwill on Facebook. And now let's return to speaking with our guest, Ken Buttigan. Ken, I was wondering if you would just expand for our listeners the understanding of nonviolence. We've talked a little bit about basic physical nonviolence, and we've talked a little bit about nonviolent action as a tool of social change. But what about, many of us are familiar with structural and systemic violence, things like poverty and low wages or mass incarceration. But what are the nonviolent alternatives? Are there like two or three that you might lift up to kind of make our minds more aware of?
Sure. Well, first, I would just give you my description of nonviolence. And for me, nonviolence is it's a force. It's not a non-thing. It's a force. It's a force for transformation, justice, and the well-being of all, not almost all, but all, that is neither violent nor passive. So there are several other descriptions that I found really helpful, like Alternatives to Violence calls it transforming power. Jonathan Schell, writer, calls it cooperative power. Dorothy Day called it love in action. And Martin Luther King Jr., I think this is the one I love the most, the love that does justice. Sometimes in our culture, we have love on one side and justice on the other, and he smushes them together and saying it's the love that does justice. So nonviolence, it's a stand for justice and a method for helping to create it. And it pursues this goal not with passivity or retaliation, but like I've been saying, this third way of creative engagement and loving and determined resistance. So it's a lot of things that sometimes the stereotypes of nonviolence prevent us from seeing, but I want to ask myself and others to suspend those stereotypes, to recognize that it's an orientation that's different from the orientation of violence and domination. It's a set of principles, it's a method, and it's specific strategies to put the power of this love that does justice into practice. It's a way of life, but it's also a means of transforming the world. And it challenges the power of and belief in violence. And that's a big part of this for me. We are taught to believe that violence saves us, that violence works. I love what our mutual friend Michael Nagler, who studied nonviolence for a long time, says. He says that violence sometimes works and never works. Nonviolence sometimes works and always works. And frankly, Sherry and Rivera, this is what I've seen in my life over and over again. Gandhi called his autobiography My Experiments with Truth. And I've been experimenting like Gandhi. I've been experimenting with this power, this force, for a long time. And that's what I see, that I may not get immediate results, but the world is better because I decided not to use either violence or passivity. And violence claims to work, and yet I agree with Michael. It never works. It just trips off usually into retaliation, revenge, doesn't solve the problem, just kicks it down the road. So specific techniques, well, we were talking about social movements. I think it's really important to be part of these kinds of efforts. We don't have to invest our whole lives. We can invest 2 hours a month. All the great social movements, while we remember people like Dr. King and Rosa Parks, for example, you know, really it was ordinary people putting in their 2 hours a month, and sometimes thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people doing that. We can all do that. And I firmly believe that the principles of nonviolence, transforming us versus them, thinking and doing, each of us has a piece of the truth, that we are all one. These actually help whatever we do get better. But it's certainly true in terms of building a better world.
Yeah. And Ken, I was thinking specifically also just about that sustainability or renewable energy, unarmed peacekeeping, de-escalation skills for person-to-person conflicts, racial justice, living wages, affordable housing, restorative justice, democracy. These things are all encompassed within the practical applications of what a nonviolent world looks like, what is nonviolence in practice. So I just thought having some of that as a framework helps us understand what is meant by a culture of active nonviolence.
Mm-hmm. Ken, beginning with the last thing you said about this being one living system, that we're all one and that we're all connected, this goes back to something that I wrote about earlier in the week about this idea that self-care and self-love is part of a sacred promise that we're keeping in remembering that connectivity, that oneness with one another and with a divine source. And so when we think about this unity and this oneness that we're all talking about, and we think about the issue of self-care and self-love, and we apply it to that, sometimes it's not always easy to show up for ourselves. And we recognize that we take care of the things and the people that we love and care about differently than we do the things that aren't important to us. There is a considerable amount more care that's given and taken with those things that we care about the most. And so when we're talking about creating these types of movements, I mean, that certainly is part of it. Also recognizing that there is no other side. If this is one unified system, if we're part of one living ecosystem and we're connected as one spiritual being, which many of us in this work believe that we are, then we have to be able to apply that in the way that we engage this imagined other that we're perceiving and find ways to move forward with some type of harmony and balance. And so how do we engage not only those who aren't directly involved or passionately committed to the work that's going on? Because we know that we're all directly involved, whether it's our group being targeted or our backyard being targeted. But not everybody understands that, and not everybody is impacted by that. So how do we reach those people, and how do we reach those people who we perceive as being on the other side of us in this process, so that what we're creating going forward doesn't perpetuate violence and division, that it actually helps to foster unity amongst all of those who are living here in this one beautiful world that we share?
Well, that's the $64 billion question, Sherry. I think it goes to the heart of the promise and challenge of nonviolence, is to live in a way that assumes that even those one is in struggle with, that there is a place where we can meet. We talk about these two hands of nonviolence. On the one hand, I will not cooperate with this injustice, but I'm the other hand, I'm open to you as a human being. And so I think about the three phases of truth that we sometimes talk about at Pace Bene. The first is it's ridiculed. The secondly, it's fiercely and violently opposed. And the third, it becomes self-evident. And some of us are living in stage one, and some of us are living in stage two, and some of us are living in stage three. And the more I thought about that particular simple little model, I thought, oh, well, even if I'm in stage one and somebody else is in stage three, we can all get there. We all have this connection. So it's not to be frustrated as much as compassionate and open. But I think with nonviolence, you're using the most powerful language you have at your disposal, your own vulnerability, to risk an engagement, so that kind of awareness of the connectivity of all of us is possible. You're asking about people who are not involved and the other people who are on the other side, supposedly. But yeah, I think it's helpful not to think of them on the other side. I think it's helpful to think that this is a problem that has to be solved, or some ball of yarn that has to be untangled, so that we can meet each other to do that. Now, sometimes it takes building whole movements to create the possibility for that. I'm remembering George Wallace, who was the great example of white racism, the great example of white supremacy in the 1950s, who, as governor of Alabama, stood in the doorway of the university there and said he would not let African-American students be admitted to the university. He said, segregation then, segregation now, segregation forever. On the 30th anniversary of the Selma March, he came to that celebration and apologized for his actions and said, you were right and I was wrong. Now, that's not always going to happen, but I think that's a function of a movement that helped create the conditions where even somebody who was so tightly identified with his racism and the system that he was part of could get loose from that. And I think it's also because that movement started to make inroads in our society, so that it would give him some breathing space to do that. That gives me hope. That I can challenge my own racism, that we all can come to a place where we're going to solve problems together as opposed to simply polarize.
You know, your story about George Wallace made me think that sometimes in our struggles, we very quickly and easily think about the black and white racial justice struggles in this country and forget about the many, many, many other kinds of struggles that go on constantly because injustice abounds. But one thing that came to mind was another action that took place in Chicago at St. Sabina's Church, where the rivaling gang members came together for a basketball tournament and to mutually call, along with some very famous basketball players, for the end of the use of violence within the gangs in Chicago. And that, to me, that was a very profound act of peace building and of nonviolence, to actually acknowledge that when violence happens, we are all wounded by it. Those who suffer it, who are hurt by it, who are killed by it, those who perpetrate it, as we are seeing within our veterans who are coming back, having inflicted violence on other people and witnessed horrific violence and perpetrated it, and then their struggles with suicides and depressions and mental illness and PTSD, that all of these cross currents and ripples of harm and trauma and suffering and fear are like a pond in which we've thrown 1,000 bombs or 1,000 stones, and the ripples keep knocking up against each other, and that it's not always easy to find our way towards the place of reconciliation, but I think that is ultimately the path that we are trying to go on. And I wanted to ask you, because we had you on the show a few months ago to talk about the Vatican Conference on Just Peace and Nonviolence, which is very much a story of a church, a religious group, that has caused a lot of violence and oppression around the world, and in some places still causes violence and oppression and abuse to people around the world. But the church held a Just Peace Conference to talk about overturning the just war theory. And since that time, there have been some rather remarkable developments within the Catholic Church around the possibility of ending just war theory. And I was hoping you could update our listeners on some of what has been going on since the time of the conference and our last discussion with you, because it really fits in with the work of building a culture of peace and active nonviolence. Catholics represent 1 billion people worldwide, and so it's a major pillar of support either for violence, war, domination, and conquest, as it has been in many ways for thousands of years, or the choice to go a different way. So please share with us some of what's been going on.
Oh, Rivera, it's been mind-bogglingly amazing to me. So those of us who helped organize the conference that took place April 11th through the 13th earlier this year have been virtually daily working on the follow-up to this. As you know, that conference was co-sponsored with the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, whose president, Cardinal Peter Turkson, brought a warm message from the Pope and who was actively involved in helping us create our final statement, which was really calling on the Church to be converted to the nonviolence of Jesus, finally, after 2,000 years, and to not only renounce just war, but its violence that it has perpetrated, as you were saying, the oppression and persecution and violence. We talked a bit about that in the last show. But what's been so amazing is several of the developments. There's all kinds of organizing going on. We've had some good webinars globally. We have lots of endorsements now from organizations around the country and the world. We're seeking to, as you said, an encyclical on nonviolence, which would be a major church document that would really call the church to recenter, to recommit to the centrality of gospel nonviolence or Jesus's nonviolence or nonviolence in general at every level of the church. And then we're to do that, and we're to do that humbly and in a sense of confession to its own violence. It would also call on the world to really take a very serious look at this alternative to passivity on the one hand and violence on the other. So a couple developments. When we were in Rome, Cardinal Turkson approached us and asked us to submit a proposal to the Pope that his next World Day of Peace message, which is always given on January 1st at the new year, be on the theme of nonviolence. Nothing like that had ever happened before. There is no official document from the Catholic Church on nonviolence. But he came to us and asked, he says, I don't have any control over this, but go ahead and submit this. So we did. And out of all the other proposals, the Pope chose this one on nonviolence. So for the last month or so, some of us have been working again daily on writing a backgrounder for the Pope on this which may, some of which may or may not be used, we don't know, in this message that's going to happen in January. So there's that. We have been seeing all kinds of things that indicate that the work conference we did has had really pretty strong impact on both Turkson and even apparently, from what we can tell from something that was published just recently, even the Pope himself was very impacted by what we did. So we're working. We're trying to get a meeting in Rome, another meeting. We're trying to move forward on this. We're also trying to think through what concretely would happen were an encyclical like this promulgated at every level of the church, very concretely. What kind of training would be needed? What kind of preaching? What kind of theology? I mean, there's so many levels to this that we're kind of pursuing. It's in process, and maybe when we speak again, we'll have more news. But I've been encouraged that this didn't just disappear after April, but there seems to be some movement in the direction by this Pope to move more clearly and directly into the really emphasizing the importance of nonviolence.
The power of that is hard to conceptualize because for so long we have had this idea of war being a noble action embedded not only into our social contract but into our religious doctrine. And to have that change, to be able to transmit that message out into the world that we've become lost. We have gone off in a direction that is out of alignment, not only with our ability to survive here on this planet, but also out of alignment with these spiritual teachings that have become embedded into religiosity in a way that has taken them away from the core truths that tied them together. And that piece, that tiny little piece, which goes back to being able to acknowledge that we are somehow complicit in our current state of being, that, like you said, it's like a confessional, right? For us to acknowledge our role in creating this trajectory away from survival, away from unity, away from harmony and peace, and all of the ways that we have done that and embedded that into all of our social contracts, our political documentations, our declarations, and our religious doctrine are evidence of that misguidedness that has directed our path is really critical. I mean, it's really powerful to think about. It's a global opportunity for saying, I was wrong, and I'm sorry, and let's move forward in a different way. And it sounds like such a simple thing, but the power of that can't be overlooked, I don't think. I think that it's a chance for true opportunity for reconciliation across a diverse spectrum of issues and peoples that have been impacted by this throughout history.
Mm, wow, that is so well put, Jerry. And I would just add a couple things. I know we're coming up to end of time here, but one thing I'd say is one of the participants, most of our participants in Rome were people on the ground. We had some bishops, we had some theologians, but one of the persons was a Jesuit priest named Francisco de Rue, who said at the time, look, in Colombia, where he'd been working for 40 years, that the just war theory had fueled and legitimated both sides in the conflict and kept that going for half a century. And he said, it's time to end that legitimation. And just this week, with the final ascension of the peace treaty in Colombia, I just read a story yesterday on his role in trying to get to broker this agreement. And I think it's fitting that, and he says, had the church not played that role of legitimating violence, it it would have been a very different situation. But the other thing I just say is that I think the way you put it so well, and I think that it goes back to campaign nonviolence in the sense that all of us have to, or at least I will speak for myself, I have to confess my violence. I have to, how am I keeping this violent system of domination going? I think a real culture of peace and nonviolence will include that process of conversion and transformation, of metanoia, of metamorphosis, really. And that's what I most look forward to, is our recognizing, our naming our violence. After all, the word nonviolence, most of it is the word violence. But also out of that kind of cleansing or that chastening, that real transformation, healing can have, real reconciliation can happen.
I think that's very powerful, Ken, just to even reflect on, as myself, having been involved in campaign on violence and organizing actions here, what happens when we bring in that dimension of really grappling with our own violence, both physically, emotionally, structurally, culturally, systemically, and committing to a path of inner and outward and utter transformation. I want to just remind our listeners that this is Ken Buttigieg we're talking with, that he is the executive director of Pace Bene. He is also a professor at DePaul University, and he has a great new book out called Nonviolent Lives, People and Movements, Changing the World Through the Power of Active Nonviolence. Ken, we are well over time for our interview today, but it has been such a rich and full conversation. What are any last words or thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners before we head out for today?
Well, I want to say that we all have more power than we think. And I just invite us to really exercise that loving, beautiful, determined, stubborn power for a world where everyone counts and where this planet can thrive.
Thank you, Ken.
Thanks for having me, Jerry and Rivera.
Always a pleasure to speak with you, Ken.
I need you to be love, love, love.
Thanks this week to our guest, Ken Buttigieg, and to my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun, who, as always, has added some great enlightenment and wisdom and insight to the show in ways that only she can. I appreciate you, Rivera. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, Words and Music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And if you're looking for more information about Campaign Nonviolence, you can find that at www.campaignnonviolence.org. That's nonviolence without a dash, because we're not saying non, we're not saying violence, we're saying a powerful active force in the universe called nonviolence. I want to thank my co-host Sherry Mitchell, who, in addition to adding her wisdom to the show, is a great source and a deep source of friendship and illumination in my own personal life. It's always an honor to be with her in whatever form that takes. So thank you, Sherry. You can connect with her illuminations on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it if you ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week, we are honored to have Ken Buttigieg come back to remind us of the ongoing work that is being done to shape a new path forward for us all. During the Campaign Nonviolence Week of Actions, close to 800 actions were registered, an amazing number. Yet, it's even more heartening to realize that this is only a fraction of the global work that is being done to bring more sanity, humanity, and harmony into our world, which offers great hope for us all. During our discussion today, Ken has challenged us all to consider how we can actively participate in the movement of movements, which is the name being given to the global uprising that is moving us all toward a more nonviolent way of being in relationship with one another and with Mother Earth. Perhaps you'll take some time to answer those questions and determine what you have to contribute to this movement by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew?